sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A mixed employment report, a mini crash for the British pound, massive cleanup from both the Hurricane Matthew and by the Trump campaign, which will both take weeks, if not longer, to clean up. We have some listener questions, which we're going to answer, and a note that Columbus Day is on Monday. Bond markets are closed, stock markets are open. All this and much more on episode 479 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, good Sunday to you. It's Sunday night. It is the 9th of October, 2016, coming into the end of the year. This is Andrew Horowitz, your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. Last week, we had kind of a crazy schedule. I rode in on the red eye, as you know, and we had a short show discussing a couple of the topics from Vegas and the things that I saw there, some of the week ahead that I saw as well. And this week, well, we have a kind of another weird week in terms of scheduling, because the Hurricane Matthew, that is, that was coming, well, we had to close the office. We had to button everything up, shutter it up, put all sorts of plastic over everything, do some backups on the cloud, and, of course, close the doors as the hurricane was barreling down. So that took us down for about a day and a half. Last week, fortunately, the hurricane didn't seem to be as destructive as it could have been for South Florida. But of course, we did see a significant amount of damage up the coast, particularly in the areas of North Florida into South Carolina and some Georgia. So our thoughts are with you for those that are in that area, in that region. Fortunately, also, I don't think that hurricane is coming back. Did you see this crazy loop it was going to make? It was going to go up the coast, up to South Carolina, make a right turn, come back south, and loop all the way around back to South Florida at one point. Now it seems that the hurricane is just going to make a right turn and go east and keep away from us. So that's good to know. We have a lot of things to talk about. We have some listener questions I'm going to answer, and I want to get into some of the things that are really going to be moving markets this week. This week also, on top of the fact that we've had last week, we had some Jewish holidays in there. We had the hurricane. This week, right in the middle of the week also, we have Yom Kippur, the end of this Jewish holiday segment of time. And that's going to be on Tuesday evening into Wednesday. Now, let's kind of get down with some of the economics. Talk about that first, because I think it was really interesting to see what happened and the reaction with markets last week. We saw that employers added about 156,000 net new jobs to their payrolls in September. Well, that's good. Estimates, though, were for about 175,000 approximately. In August, the gain was revised up to 167,000. So we had a monthly job growth that averaged 192,000 per month in quarter three, which was an improvement from the previous quarter where it averaged 146,000. The unemployment rate, though, ticked up a little bit. It went to 5% in September, and that was because more people entered the workforce and the labor participation rate moved a bit higher. That's generally seen as something that's good. What's weird is that we've had this very strange statistical anomaly that we have seen recently where unemployment rate has been going down, and at the same time, we hit multi-decade lows of the labor participation rate, how many people are actually in the workforce, showing that, well, the unemployment numbers, no matter what they came in at, were suspect. And they were suspect because we have less people in the workforce, and the calculation of the unemployment rate goes on how many people are actually working, how many people are in the workforce, and therefore there were some questions by a lot of economists about the strength of the unemployment numbers. Now, unfortunately, the unemployment rate did move a little bit higher. Now, that again was because of the labor participation rate that got better. It would have been very nice to see the labor participation rate moving higher and the unemployment rate moving lower at the same time, but that didn't happen. Okay, still, we're at 5%, which by most metrics is very close to full employment. We also saw that yearly wage growth reached 2.6% in terms of growth, and the average hourly wage rose about 6 cents to about $25.79, which, by the way, is much higher than the minimum wage. A couple of other things last week that I found very interesting. If you remember last month, there was some wonky numbers that came out of the ISM, both on the ISM manufacturing number and the ISM services. And when you look at those, you have to say, wait, what is going on here? We see a very significant drop off in those numbers, both on the manufacturing, which was getting close to a significant level that you'd have to say, well, we're in a confirmed contraction area. And the services, which is a much more important number when it comes to the U.S., also falling very significantly. Well, just 1 month later, here we are. And the ISM number for the manufacturing improved to 51.5, recovering from below 50. And the non-manufacturing, or the service index, listen to this, rose 5.7 points, moving to 57.1. So what was that all about? Was it just some weird calendar-based situation over the summer that showed that people just weren't doing anything in the area of services? Or is this the aberration? That's really the big question, right? Which one is wrong? Which one is outside the norms? Which one is really kind of the concerning factor? Is it that we are, in fact, moving closer to a quote-unquote recessionary environment? It doesn't feel that way. It doesn't look that way if you kind of look at all of the different numbers from all the various economic reports that came out. You can't say really, listen, you can make a case that, oh yeah, a lot of stuff's inflated and it's bogus and this is governmental numbers that are, you know, behind the scenes, they're just marking them up, and forget that. Let's focus on what we know, because we can't do anything in terms of understanding how to invest, how to look at things, if we're going to start bringing up conspiracy theories and models that are just not really in the truest sense today's. We have to keep everything on par. We have to look at what we know, what we have accessible to us, and what is in fact, the things that are that everybody else is using. Now, in the future, if in fact we do enter into a recessionary environment, and there were some clues and some things that didn't look right, just like last month didn't, we can go back and say, well, maybe there are some things in there that we have to adjust and make some changes. But right now, for the moment, gang, we can't really say with any sort of confidence that we have an impending recession just around the corner. Again, unless a lot of things change suddenly. So the good news was that we did see the ISM service and the ISM manufacturing numbers have a very significant comeback in the latest month and latest readings. Well, what happened with oil? What happened with gold last week? Wow. Two different directions. On Friday, gold closed at $1,251, down about 5% for the week. Started the week off on a very bad note. The dollar has been rising. There's been some concern about central banks lacking any kind of participation in the gold markets because obviously they need their money for other things, maybe even selling some of the gold they have on hand and using that to prop up their various banking sectors, their economies, etc. Then you have the problem with a lack of jewelry buying around the world. Nothing really seen as a catalyst for gold and silver. Silver also had a very, very bad week. And if you didn't see, you have to look at the gold miners, particularly look at the symbol GDX. GDX was pummeled, to say the least. All of the gold miners and anything related to silver and any of the firms that do anything or related to mining for gold or any kind of the precious metals really had a very difficult week. And the dollar, which is not always 100% correlated to these, did in fact move higher. And there's a lot of reasons for that. However, oftentimes you see at the same time gold moving in one direction, you see other commodities moving like oil in the same direction. That didn't happen. What we saw was the continuation of the promises and the rhetoric from OPEC and non-OPEC nations, particularly Saudi Arabia, saying, hey, you know what? We are, in fact, going to do some kind of a production freeze. The production freeze was not very significant. However, it was seen as enough to prompt short sellers to start moving out of their positions, collecting their profits after a very long drop for oil and a very profitable drop if they were short for an extended period of time. So might as well take some of those profits off the table. Maybe some of the hedging was removed, etc. The problem we have with oil is that once we reach this $50 level, once we get close to 50, what we're going to find is that there's a lot of resistance. You know, not exactly 50, maybe 51, 52, in the low 50s, we'll call it. And the reason for that is that we'll see rig counts start to move higher. One of the things that we do know is that fracking in particular and also deriving oil from the oil sands is a very expensive proposition. It's also very expensive to do deep sea drilling, for example, in for Brazil. So these are some of the names of companies that are in there, or the companies that are inside those spaces and how they actually drill or get the oil. Those still have a lot of problems. But as we get closer to that 50 level, other areas that have a lower cost overall to bring the oil up from the ground will, in fact, be able to restart many of their idled rigs and other facilities that are involved in either refining or involved in exploration, possibly. Because now it's a profitable situation for them, or it's at least closer to profitability. We still have a long way to go for some of the areas of fracking and oil sands and maybe even deep sea. But what's interesting is that what you'll have is a natural process right now with the excess liquidity, excess inventory that you have in the around the world, whether it's in some kind of storage facility or it's in floating cargo tankers. There is an enormous amount of inventory out there. Demand is still not that high. So therefore, at about 50 or so, the level where it is not profitable still for some, but it is profitable finally for others, you'll see that those players are going to start to actually go in and restart much of their production. And that will bring more inventory. The amount that the quote-unquote promise by OPEC to freeze or to drop the few hundred thousand barrels is really going to be brought back online once oil sustains this $50 level. I'd be very surprised to see, I'm going to just give you a number, over 55, at least in the short term. There may be a short squeeze that moves it up for some reason, but really the powers of the supply-demand equation, I just don't see it. I just don't see it. Again, unless a lot of things change, unless we have an incredible growth spurt all of a sudden around the world, which I don't know what would cause that with what's going on around the world. Whether we have, incredible demand all of a sudden for whatever reason for oil. But, you know, you can go down the list and think about this on your own and think about that, how, you know, it makes sense that there's a natural cap to where oil is going to go. We'll finish it off with on the economic side with talking about the markets for what they did for the week. While the softer numbers or softer than expected numbers on the jobs report were seen initially as a further driver to keep the Fed on hold for a period of longer than expected, maybe even move them out possibly to 2017, the reality I think that most players are seeing right now and by the Fed fund futures is there's a pretty good chance that December is the time when they're going to raise rates. So for the week, the S&P 500 was down about 0.75%. The NASDAQ was down about 0.35%. And we saw about the same for the Dow Jones. Now, what's coming up this week? So Monday's Columbus Day. The bond market is closed, which, by the way, is kind of interesting because there's been a lot of action in the bond market. If you recall, I talked about some time ago how, I think I talked about it here and also on DH Unplugged. As a matter of fact, it was one of my picks of the week that I said that, you know, it's about time that I believe that bond rates may start to creep higher. And it may be an interesting time to start looking at shorting bonds. As a matter of fact, we had a whole episode or a big part of an episode recently dedicated to my concern about your bond holdings. My concern about, you know, if you have a bond portfolio, watch the maturities, watch the duration, watch the overall makeup of the portfolio, because it has been a very profitable trade and it's been a profitable position for years. And if we see any normalization here, there may be a turnaround. And as we are finding that there is a consistent lack of certainty, as well as, I would say, there is some question coming into the picture about what the central banks at this point can do and can't do, what ammunition they have left, whatever you want to call it. But there's a concern about really how much more the central banks can do at this point. And if there is any kind of rate hike here and there is a currency bump that's going to go on and concern about cross-currency rates, and maybe there'll be some selling that happens because of the arbitrage that's been going on for some time with selling European bonds, selling Japanese bonds, buying U.S. bonds. Maybe the U.S. bonds are an area of concern. So we did see that the 10-year ticked up pretty well for the week. And the bond market being closed on Monday, you know, could add for additional volatility for the rest of the week. You're also going to see that federal government offices, banks will be closed also on Monday. Now, Tuesday, here we go. Earnings season. Earnings season is starting. We're going to see Alcoa come out, Barracuda Networks, Fastenal, Wednesday Federal Reserve releasing minutes from their September meeting. We're going to see some from some transportation companies like CSX. Now, Thursday, we're going to have some more interesting and important numbers from Delta Airlines, Winnebago, Wind Resorts. Friday, Yellen is speaking because you can't have just one Fed speaker a week. You can't have two. You can't have five. You got to have at least, you know, seven or eight speaking in any given week. And we're going to see some of the earnings also this week from Citigroup, JP Morgan, PNC Bank, and Wells Fargo. We're going to see how much of a hit Wells Fargo earnings are going to take this quarter. It really may not be this quarter that we see such a dramatic move, because remember that over the last couple of weeks, several major firms have pulled their business from Wells Fargo. So it may actually be into next quarter. So we're going to have to be on the watch for what their outlook is and their guidance in their conference call. We're also going to see the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index and retail sales, as well as the September PPI this week. So lots of very interesting things that will be coming up, things to be watching, things that will move markets. And you have noticed, if you haven't, I'm going to tell you, well, volatility has picked up a bit, right? We've seen definitely a lot more volatility than we saw in the doldrums in the belly of the summer into, you know, end of July, we'll call it, into August. I mean, it was kind of nothing going on. Little bitty bits here, little there. Now we're seeing kind of moves that are very substantial. Still, the market doesn't want to give up the ghost. There is not a lot of selling that's substantial for more than, let's say, one day. And there's really not a lot of buying that goes on for more than one day. Let's talk about the the dollar for a second, and currencies. I think this is really interesting. If you didn't see this, this is something that you really need to check out, because we had a very substantial move on the British pound late last week. As a matter of fact, overnight, there was approximately, I would say, about an 8% move instantaneously in a quick moment on the British pound, specifically the cross between the British pound and the US dollar. You could see that very clearly. And the reason for that is still kind of unknown, but there's a couple of reasons that we could possibly look at as in theories, if you will, of what went on there. And, you know, you don't usually see a currency move 6 or 7%. Now, there was a recovery, by the way. And this is the biggest move that we saw since the Brexit vote. Now, here's a couple of the triggers that may have been responsible that I was thinking about, and what I researched and what I came up with from all the different news sources that were really reporting what was going on. But could have been it could have been just as simple as a fat finger. Now, if you don't know what a fat finger is, by the way, I want you to picture a gigantic fat finger, and I want you to picture a keyboard. And I want you to picture that somebody smushed a number on the keyboard and maybe hit the sell button. Instead of, let's say, as an example, they were trying to sell 1,000 units, they sold 1 million units. So we call that a fat finger. Okay? A fat finger trade oftentimes recovers quickly. It's sudden. And you oftentimes also get a report back rather quickly that, oh, yeah, there was a trade that was misdirected, or it was not the actual trade that should have gone on, and it's been cleaned up very quickly. Now, we haven't heard that, the reports that it was a fat finger. So what else could it be? Well, there was low volumes. Clearly, overnight, there's some low volumes that are going on, and maybe there was some sellers that came in because there was a realization that the UK government, in their latest approach, may have very little or no access to the European single market. And that could be an issue. Because if they're going to go after this thing, this Brexit, very quickly, and in fact, they're not going to fight, a lot of the players are saying, hey, you know what? You're going to have to be on your own. And they're going to say, okay, fine, we're just going to pull out. We're not going to deal with you guys. Which I can't really see that being the case. That would be just devastating to a lot of areas. It would be devastating to the British markets, generally speaking, well, their economy. That would be a real problem. You know, interestingly enough, of course, as the dollar moved up and the euro moved up and the British pound moved down, the British pound lost a significant amount of money. What happened? Well, the stock market in England rallied, because there's a lot of exporters that benefit from a lower currency. But there's some real problems with what's going on with their currency. First of all, a disorderly move on the British pound could be very problematic. We've already seen that there's some profit warnings that are starting. We have inflation possibly quickening, higher costs for those that deal in a currency that is based in the British pound. So while their exports will be benefiting, their imports will be a problem. That hurts us, by the way. And it also hurts other companies inside the UK that rely on parts and other items in their manufacturing process. We know, we've seen this before, particularly with Japan. Now, certainly there is a benefit when it comes to a currency being softer, but a disorderly move in the currency can't be absorbed very well. Those that have hedged incorrectly are hurt. The supply chain gets out of whack. I mean, a 6% move means that it's going to cost them 6% more to get the products to bring into their country that they may be, and that's where inflation comes in. Things cost more money. So there can be a big inflation move, or they have to increase the prices of their products that they're manufacturing, et cetera. And by the way, it also creates disarray in global markets. Now, like I said, the drop was a precipitous drop, very quickly, very pronounced, very suddenly, and it did come back a bit. Still finished down about 2.5%. I think for the whole week it was down about 2.5%, below the 130 level, which was an important and key level. Now, the other problem you have, and this is really the big one that I've been focusing on, is that when you have a central bank-controlled markets, so the markets are being controlled by the central bank, the currencies, the bond markets, the stock market, generally speaking, you know, with quantitative easing, with their plays to keep the currency lower, it will be very hard for the Bank of England to control inflation as these currency moves are outside the parameters and outside the boundaries of what their plans are. And the other thing is that if, in fact, they get into a problematic state in that their economy slows down, let's say, for whatever reason it may be, they have very little ability to reduce rates because it's also going to bring down their currency and it's going to create further inflation, runaway inflation. And this is a much different circumstance than just, say, quantitative easing on its own that has not created any significant inflation statistically over the last 8 years or so in the U.S. and other countries, particularly Japan, Europe, etc. This is a much different dynamic here because we're talking about very quick and very sharp moves of a currency that causes a real breakdown of all of the markets inside that country. And of course, globally, it creates some problems too. But inside that country, it creates a lot of problems. And inflation gets crazy. And the other problem is that if inflation does start to move because of this outside influence of the Brexit on the economy and on the currency, they're hard-pressed to raise the rate because that would slow down the economy even further. Problems that it's a mess. Let me just say it is a mess. So all the concerns that were there initially, the drop markets around the world due to the Brexit, that quickly and seemingly almost instantaneously disappeared 2 or 3 days later, are still at play right now. And we're starting to see a lot of the ill effects that this is going to cause start to bulge a little bit. So I keep your eye on the British pound. And I think that's going to be something that we have to watch and see the effects on companies. And I would bet dollars to donuts right now that next quarter, you're going to start to see constant currency in the discussions of many of the reporting companies during this earnings season. We didn't hear about it at all last quarter. Like the word constant currency that was so much in each and every earnings release that came out because the currency in the U.S. was moving higher and they wanted to show their best foot and say, oh, well, you know, if we didn't have this currency situation, we'd still be making all this money, blah, blah. Of course, everybody goes, oh, that's great. Oh, I like it. You know, constant currency. And yeah, they made us just as much money if it was, if. Truth be known, it wasn't. It was just a phrase they used to make us all think that, well, things are okay. But they dropped it as soon as the dollar started moving lower. When they got a tailwind from currency rather than a headwind, the whole idea of the constant currency conversation was just out the window. Now, when we see that the dollar is going to be rising again, there's some concern about companies who would do business outside the U.S., you're going to start seeing it again. I bet you you're going to start seeing it, if not this quarter, next quarter. But clearly, we're going to start, if in fact we have the dollar continue to hold at these levels, you're going to see it quite significantly in conversations. The problem is that, you know what? Fool me once. Hey, okay. Fool me twice. That's what markets are going to react and how they're going to react to this. Last time it was okay. It was a one-off. It was transitory. You know, it would be something that would, you know, move beyond as soon as the dollar moved to the other side, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if it happens again, though, I think that players are going to be a lot less inclined to just let it go. So watch the British pound, the Great Britain pound. Watch what happens with their economy. Watch some of the discussions from central banks and also some of the constant currency discussions that we're going to be seeing probably here in the U.S. as the dollar actually moves higher. You know, there was a lot of rumors last week. A lot of rumors. I'm going to talk about some of those. But first, I want to get to some of the questions that you have asked. You've asked many questions over the last few weeks, and you can go, of course, ask me anything you want about finance, and we'll either answer it on a show, or I'll answer you directly. Just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, go to the top right, click on the Ask Andrew button, and ask away. And I'll answer as best as I can. We got a few different interesting questions. There was a lot of questions about central banks and a few things, which I'm going to kind of summarize in a moment. But this one's from Ryan, Ryan S. And he says, hello, Andrew. I appreciate all that you do for us. A great podcast, both this one and DH Unplugged. Great content. And he finds DHU extremely funny. So he had a couple of different questions that he was asking me, and I thought that I would get to you about. So I'm going to get to one of these. He says that who as a country other than the U.S. is doing really well now? I've often heard no one. There was a lot of chatter about BRIC a few years back and being the ray of light. And that has not happened with Brazil, Russia, and China. Just a point, by the way, BRIC, the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, man, they were on fire for a while. So yes, they were a big part of the globalization, which is something that is in question right now. The big question of whether globalization is going to be actually the thing that really drove the economies of the world in such a way over the last decade or so, last 15 years, and is now going to be something that takes down the world because everything is so interrelated. But we did have a very good run there with these countries. And of course, once the financial crisis hit, once we saw the commodity bubble burst, yeah, there was a lot of problems with that. So what do we think of India? What are the major risk factors you see in the macro level over there? Do you folks take country-specific positions, et cetera? Is it a good idea to look at ETFs? So there's a lot of little things in there. So let's talk about India first. And let me tell you that, yes, there are several different India-based ETFs that you can find. Simply just look up India ETF and you'll find a few of those. You know, remember something, that the Indian currency, the rupee, is going to be something you're going to have to look at, because when you invest in a country-specific ETF, unless that country-specific ETF is hedged currency-wise, you're going to have the effects of the currency as well. If the currency moves down and the stocks move up and it's an equity-based portfolio, you may not make anything. So you may want to look at how to hedge out that currency to keep it so that there is no nominal effect on your portfolio. Now, India has clearly an incredibly large population, second, I guess, to what, China? Billions of people there. They're trying their best to modernize, not only from a position of individuals, but also their very poor infrastructure in most places. I mean, some areas are okay. By the way, I'll tell you more about this after the summer, because I'm going there this summer coming up. But the sanitation, the roads, I mean, there's a lot of things that have to be upgraded there. So India still has a long way to go in terms of the country in total for their infrastructure build out, et cetera. India has a very low overall average income, similar to many of the other countries around the world. Again, there's pockets of areas like the capital and a few other cities inside of India that have much better overall income and wealth levels. But India has a long way to go. And yes, there is, I think, great opportunity in India. If you compare the others in that block, when you look at areas like China, Brazil, India, and Russia, I would have to go out of those four. India, yes, being the area that I would invest in. I would also like some of the areas outside of China, like Vietnam, maybe even Cambodia. Those areas also are going to go through an incredible move towards modernization. And also, because there is cheap labor there, they will get a lot of the jobs from technology, et cetera, over the next few years, probably, as they move away from the more expensive areas around the world. We have a few different questions from Oliver, Oliver J. And he asked a lot of questions about the Quantafunda techno strategy that we use. In other words, the strategy where we look for finding stocks based on a screening criteria, looking at their fundamentals, then looking at the technicals and, you know, the buy and sell points for a stock. There's a lot of different ways to utilize this measure. And this is, by the way, in the book I wrote, The Disciplined Investor, really covers a lot of that. It's a book that's available on audiobook, by the way, through Amazon, through Audible. You can grab it there. But the thing is that when you look at trying to find a metric these days that you can do a very, you know, high-end and a big picture filtering process on, let's say, things like, well, it could be high dividends, high dividend coverage ratios, return on equity, return on asset. You can look at margin expansion, you know, whatever exactly you're using for your particular metrics inside of a screen. You know, some of that's a little bit warped these days, because we have such an incredible amount of buybacks going on, and we have also, of course, the ongoing central bank stimulus. So that's a little bit warped, but still, it is probably one of the better tools that you can use to find stocks on a first glance. Then what you could do is go a little further. Understand what's happening with the stocks overall on a basis of looking at the underlying fundamentals, understanding the balance sheets, understanding the income statements, and of course, any of the ratios that are dependent on per share type of statistics, whether it's PE or PEG ratios, whether it's the earnings per share growth, revenue per share growth, et cetera. Now, the question, though, that he asked, I think was really interesting, was how do you use this in a bear market? Or is it just for finding stocks on the long side? Now, here's what's interesting. What we have found is, over time, when we look at a specific set of filtering criteria that is geared to finding stocks that are in a high growth model. So you find a stock that has earnings growth that is consistent over a certain bar, let's call it 2%, just as a number, 2% earnings growth annually, quarter over quarter, going back maybe three years over that period. Revenue growth, of course, that's important in terms of growth and companies able to grow in a situation where they have not only earnings growth, but revenue growth. Important because we're not just dealing with just the earnings, the net. We're looking at, okay, could they actually increase the sales? Then we'll look at things like margin expansion and ROE. Those four things as an example, let's just use those as a primary case here. Now, if you take a big enough starting point of stocks, so let's say we take 4,000 or 5,000, the big, you know, the Russell 3,000, you know, enough stocks to look at, and we go back in time, and we see that, you know, there's about, I'm just, again, making up numbers here, 100 stocks make it through this very selective screen 3 years ago, and then 120, you know, 2.5 years ago. And we go quarter by quarter, and all of a sudden now you see only 75 stocks are there. So to answer your question, Oliver, how do you do it in a bear market? Well, one of the things is to identify when is a bear market, when is a correction, when is the economy slowing? One of the things you could do is if you find that on a growth-oriented screen, on the first part of the quantitative analysis, on the first part of that, when you're looking at finding stocks that meet certain criteria that are very much in line with growth-oriented type of metrics, if all of a sudden you're seeing much fewer stocks come through that screen, that should be a signal. Signal that, wait a minute, something's not right. For whatever reason, companies are no longer able to meet this criteria or that criteria. Why is that? Is it something that's systematic across the board with regard to maybe what's happening with interest rates? Is it something that is happening with currency? Is it something that's happening with the economy slowing down? Why is that? And it should be a signal that, hey, wait a minute, something's happening here. And you could look at those companies that are falling off as those companies that are no longer able to meet that criteria, as areas that you could be looking into going short, as long as they don't make the screen. Those are companies that, for whatever reason, are not able to keep pace in an environment that's slowing. And those are the ones that probably would be the ones that would be selling off significantly. Does that make sense? So the first part is to say, wait a minute. Hey, I realize a lot less stocks are making the cut, making the grade, able to be filtered through this screening process. That should be an alert that something's not right. And we're not talking about one off, one quarter here. We're talking about a process and a sequential move lower on the number of stocks that can make it through that screen. Again, a growth screen. And then you look at those stocks that are starting to fall off and use them as some that you can actually utilize potentially for shorts. So hopefully that answers your question. Let's get to the next question here. Let's see here. Again, you could ask, these questions are, you know, you could ask whatever you'd like over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's see which one. We had a couple here. Let me just go through this one. This one was good, I thought. This question was from Victoria M. And she writes that she started listening to this podcast and loves it great. She thinks it's unbelievable. And all that, Grace, thank you so much. A lot of nice things she said here. She said that she's currently a sophomore at a private university in Texas and majoring in finance. And Victoria says that I know that there is a large percentage of college students with student loan debt. So my question is it possible to invest with debt? Now, is it more common than ever for college students to come out of school with student loan debt? But that should that stop us from investing early on? I always hear from popular finance gurus about the power of compounding interest and taking advantage of it while you're young. Any thoughts? Well, there's two thoughts on the compounding of interest. Number one, if you have a lot of debt outstanding, you know, it depends on what you think your long-range returns are going to be on your portfolio, but it may make sense to pay off that debt as soon as possible in order to have the freedom to have excess cash in order to invest. Now, if it's going to take you 15 years or 10 years or 7 years to actually pay off that debt, well, maybe you want to start trying your best to put a few bucks aside. Yes, the magic of compounding of interest, the magic of compounding of your returns over time, especially when you're young, and the younger that you start, the more it works in your favor, I think is something that you should very much consider. However, I think that I would be really giving you poor advice if I said that, yeah, don't worry about the loans. They'll take care of themselves long term. I mean, the fact of the matter is every amount of interest that you're paying on that loan is a negative rate against your portfolio. If you have a $10,000 loan, $10,000 portfolio, you're paying, you know, 7% on your college loan. You're making 7% on your portfolio. What did you really make that year? Nothing. Now, it may feel a lot better that you have some savings, but the fact of the matter is that you probably should, in fact, do a little bit of both, but the loans are important to pay off as soon as possible. And our last question is from Hashim J. Hi, Andrew, he says. Hello, Hashim. Fantastic show as usual. I have a question on minimum volatility funds and to what extent they have a role in a retirement fund or portfolio. What real purpose would they serve if one already has a retirement portfolio that consists of equities and bonds? Are there further diversification benefits for existence? For instance, thanks for your insights. All right, Hashim. It's a good question because I'm not a real fan of this whole minimum volatility funds. I think every once in a while what happens is that for whatever reason, and it could be a trend or a theme is emerging in markets and it's catching the attention of investors. And therefore, what happens is that the funds and ETFs go after it for marketing purposes. So we saw back in Y2K, back in 2000, and we've seen in different times of the cycles that there have been these kind of things. We saw the target portfolios for a time that seemed to come into play and then everybody hated them. We've seen, of course, the recent things like we talk about on DH Unplugged, the millennial ETF that came in, all the millennial type of stocks that are going to benefit from the millennials are in an ETF. And we have, for example, HACK, which is a cybersecurity type of ETF. So you have this situation where there is a theme. And these minimum volatility funds are really nothing more than, I think, as you probably know, the balance funds of what we had before, but they weren't as sexy. That's a balance fund. It's 60-40 stocks and bonds. But if a minimum volatility fund means what? The problem is they're higher dividend paying, which offsets some of the volatility potentially. They're larger caps in terms of their size, so maybe they have less volatility there too. In the end, what's going to end up happening is that these minimum volatility funds will be found out probably to be nothing more than just balance funds. And, you know, when the volatility hits, I would venture to say whenever that is, and whenever there is the movement away from this thematic style of investing by individuals, you're not going to see any benefit here. So the answer to your question is, while it could have, or at least there are some diversification potential benefits from this, I don't know if you already did that within your portfolio. You have a balance of stocks and bonds. You know, you may want to look to see if you can break up the bond portfolio to be better diversified or more appropriate diversified for this time in the economic cycle, and see if you can break up your stock portfolios to have domestic and international, et cetera, and a different sizing of the stocks inside your portfolio that you could probably create with ETFs and mutual funds that are straight up. I don't like to have mutual funds in a portfolio that have thematic type of investing, because I don't know what they're going to be doing. And usually what we want to do, and we do in our global allocation strategies, is we target a specific area like large cap, small cap, mid cap, domestic equities, foreign equities, ex Japan, or for example, we want to have emerging market stocks, emerging market bonds that are hedged or unhedged, or whatever it may be. We want to have a certain amount of tips, a certain amount of commodities, but I want to know that that is what my investment is going to do. So if I'm right or wrong by investing in that segment, at least I know that that's what they're doing. When I have these mutual funds that are constructed with a broad base of anything goes and trying to get minimum volatility, et cetera, I don't know where they really fall in the framework of a well-diversified portfolio. So what happens is that you're therefore questioning, you know, well, did they work? Did they not work? Is there a little bit of a bleed over into the large cap that I really should be accounting for when I invest here? Or is there more of a small cap at this point? And how much hedging they have? Is there any currencies in there maybe? So what happens is that all of a sudden your diversification is kind of, it blows up on you. You don't know what is going on with that position. So therefore, we don't really utilize those. It just makes a mess of a properly diversified portfolio, at least from what we are trying to, you know, our goal is for that portfolio. So I hope that answers your question. Again, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's finish up the show with a couple other pieces on the area of the rumor mill. You know, this is when oftentimes when there's a quiet period, when it's maybe not a lot of central bankers, there's some holidays, maybe there's not a lot of economic reports that are coming out. Maybe most of the earnings season is done and a few weeks away, a new one is going to be starting, is when you see the rumors start to really catch fire. We had a few of them last week. So probably two of the biggest ones that we saw was regarding Deutsche Bank and Twitter. Well, Deutsche Bank, number one, Twitter, number two. Now, the Twitter sale, the whole idea that Twitter is up for sale, there's a lot of companies that are really looking to buy this thing. It reached like a fever pitch last week when David Faber from CNBC seemingly was being fed a constant stream of BS about companies looking at and in serious negotiations to buy Twitter. Now, even when we heard that most deals were not going anywhere, not going to happen, not going to be playing out, we had the tagline of, but others are still interested. I don't know what was going on with CNBC and with David Faber. Now, when we heard the news that Google was out, Twitter crashed about 20% on that news, only a few days after they had that 20% move higher with the idea that, hey, they're up for sale. But it seems that Twitter is reaching the end of their time period, looking for of companies looking at them as potential buyout candidates. So I guess it was dropped by Google, Microsoft, a few other parties that were looking at this. And lastly, the last holdout seemed to have been Salesforce, which I never understood. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the stock of Salesforce and Google and all these other players that were possibly going to be buying Twitter, the stocks were down post the announcement that they were interested. Salesforce being the most concerning. I think there was a very big nod to the no side of Salesforce buying this. As a matter of fact, their largest shareholder petitioned them, cornered them, and said, please do not do this. So they backed down, it seems, or at least Salesforce isn't formally out yet, but it looks like they're out. What's going to happen with Twitter from here? I don't know. I would think maybe David Faber's going to come. Well, now that there are not as many, Twitter may look to go private. Because I don't know who's feeding him this information, why he is so, it's newsworthy, but it's almost weird how much he's reporting on this. Now, as far as Deutsche Bank, there were some rumors and very thin rumors at the end of last week, towards the end of last week, the beginning of last week, actually it was the beginning of last week and the end of the week before that, well, Deutsche Bank is in some final negotiations with the U.S. about the $14 billion fine that's being imposed on them and the penalty due to their participation in the financial crisis back in the mid-2000s. And there was some numbers that came out that maybe it's only going to be $5 billion and all this. And the stock rallied and markets rallied because, listen, if Deutsche Bank goes under or if Deutsche Bank needs a bailout or a bail-in, if Deutsche Bank has any major need to cover this, because we're talking about a bank that has a balance sheet, I think, of $16 billion, but debt outstanding of like $170 billion or something like that. And there's more lawsuits piling up. We saw that Italy is now suing them. Well, we find out that rumor was also false. They are not at the end of the negotiation process. They are not anywhere near finalizing a deal with the U.S. So here we are. My point to all of this is be very careful. If you're going to invest on the rumors and the headlines of what we're seeing these days, particularly in a period of little other news, be very aware that you should probably do it in a quick trading method. Get in, make some money, get the heck out. Lastly, I'll mention that in terms of rumors, in terms of the desire to move markets on news headlines and information, a couple things, and you have to really focus on this whole central bank phenomena. But central banks have been really looking to, I guess it would be set up some trial balloons, see how markets react to what they're saying. The ECB was one of the recent last week. They talked about there was some things coming out about them tapering asset purchases, because one of the things we do know is that they're running out of assets to buy. At $90 billion per month, the size of the asset base that they have to buy is being quickly eaten up. That's why they have negative rates. They're buying at any price. Now, this tapering of asset prices really kind of shook things up a little bit there and concerned a few people. Kind of, I was wondering why the heck they would do that. I don't know anything that Draghi said that would even seemingly look like he was looking to taper. So I don't know where this rumor came from. It was refuted a few days later, but still maybe it's just a trial balloon because they are in fact running out of some assets to buy. Bank of Japan. Well, we know they're targeting rates in a shift to their policy. And then they come out to say, well, you know what? If that doesn't, we have other ways to do things and we have more room to ease. And again, another trial balloon being sent up. The Fed, well, they're in hike mode, and then maybe they're not going to hike. And now they come out again that a couple of players last week, things are good. And if I had my way, that I would hike rates right now. The problem is that they're doing this because they know that their end of their usefulness and their effectiveness on markets with what they have as a toolkit right now. creating massive confusion. There's no question about that. Just be on your toes. That's all I'm saying. Just be on your toes and watch for all this that's going on, this whole rumors and the stuff that comes out about buyouts and maybe, maybe not. Unless it's directly from the company and you see confirmation of that, that's another discussion entirely. If you just see it on the news, you see it on a news feed, you see it somewhere, I don't know, just floating out there somehow in the world of Twitter or wherever it is that you see it, just be very careful, skeptical, and cautious. Use your best judgment is the bottom line. A lot of it's going to be coming through, especially towards the end of the year, so just be aware of that. Anyway, that's going to wrap it up for this week. I want to thank you for joining me. Putting up with my crazy schedule of things that have been going on the last few weeks. And keep a listen to this. DH Unplugged won't be recorded, won't be going on this week due to the Jewish holidays, but we're going to resume the following week with John C. Dvorak, myself, talking about all sorts of interesting things on DH Unplugged. You can find more information about that on iTunes or dhunplugged.com. More information about this show on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you're interested in our global allocations, there's some information you can get over there as well, right on the website. Thanks a lot for joining me, and I'll talk to you next week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.